Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're recording in front of a beautiful live audience at the BFI in London as part of our Inspiring Careers in Foods events. We're here with the best new food talent and helping them meet the best employers in the industry. This episode is all about nutritionists. It's about the jobs they do today, but also what those jobs might look like in the future. There have been big advances in nutritional science, and technology is transforming the industry too, with a plethora of apps offering personalized nutrition advice. Consumers obviously have access to a vast ocean of nutritional advice via social media, but the quality of much of it is pretty questionable, if not downright bonkers at times. So it's an exciting time to be a nutritionist, but what will the job look like in 10 or 20 or maybe even 30 years' time? Well, with me to take a look at what might be on the horizon are three absolutely fantastic guests. Please welcome Lizzie Henning, company nutritionist at hospitality food service provider Baxter Story. Hello there, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Very good to have you. And we're welcoming back a previous podcast guest, registered dietitian working in the NHS and founder of Rosemary Nutrition, Rosemary Martin. Hello, Rosemary.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Great to have you as well. And we also have Laura Street, senior nutritionist at Marks & Spencer's. Hello there, Laura.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So great to have you all here on the panel. And everyone, here is your panel. Right. Well, I think it's probably worth starting by working out the different roles that different nutritionists might have. So I guess maybe, Laura, let's start with you. Is there much of a difference between working for a retailer or a manufacturer or as an independent?
I'm fortunate enough that I have actually worked as all three in my time. So all of the roles, you put together the nutrition science, how you actually implement things, and then the practicalities of what the clients that you're working with build on. So there is a difference in terms of if you're a sports nutritionist or an independent, you're looking at work with an individual. And then if you're in a manufacturer or retailer, you've got to be really aware of the regulations and what you can and can't say. And different people obviously have different interests in nutrition. So it's very interesting. People dwell at a shelf for about, you know, seconds. You think when you're nipping around the supermarket, you go for what you already know and what you want to get. So how you convey nutrition in that environment is very different to if somebody's booked in and are paying for an hour's time with you.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a tricky question. Don't think about your current role, but out of the three, which was more fun?
Well, working with elite rugby players was quite fun.
Absolutely. And why? Are the roles significantly different in what you bring to it?
Yes. So I guess the fun being in a sports club is that there's a lot of banter. And there is obviously banter and fun in any way you work. And collaboration is really key. But if you're young, you think you don't need any nutrition.
Beat it into them.
Yeah, exactly.
Lizzie, what do you think about this? The difference in working for different phases?
Well, I've been lucky enough as well. So I used to do a lot of personal nutrition, working one-on-one with people. And that was very different to what I do now. So now I'm working with hospitality, big teams, but also do lots of one-on-one, working with chef groups, which often has a lot of banter as well. But I'm fortunate now that a lot of them want to learn from me. So they do what they do and I'm bringing in my skills to work with them. But when I was doing a lot of one-on-one, that's again using a lot of my scientific knowledge to help them on a personal basis. But now I'm having an impact on a company of over 5,000 people, which is really exciting.
And does that feel better? Do you think that you go home and the things I've done today have a big impact on lots of people?
Oh, it feels really exciting.
Okay, so Rosie, banter. Banter's been mentioned twice already. Does banter crop up a lot in your work?
Well, I work a lot on my own, actually. So unless it's with myself, not so much. No, it's really nice, actually, because when I do go in and work with teams or I work with organisations I'm working with, it's all the more exciting. It's all the more fun environment, yeah.
And so, presumably you work with companies as well and you're sort of brought in. And is there a significant difference in that between that and an individual? But when you're working with an individual, presumably they will hear what you're saying. They'll think it applies specifically to them.
Yeah, and it does. And I think that's one thing that I do highlight quite a lot, because when I'm working one-on-one with people, I know their medical background. I know what's going on for them. I get what context their diet is within their lifestyle. So I can very much advise according to them in a safe way. And I think when I'm speaking to large audiences through organisations that I've been working with, I always state, you know, this isn't individualised medical or nutritional advice. This is educational for people. So you really have to make that distinction, particularly as a registered dietitian. You know, you've got to make sure you're not putting anything out there that's going to be detrimental to anyone.
Yeah. And I guess if you're dealing with an individual, you can, or hopefully you would be able to see whether or not they've actually taken you up on the advice that you've given them, which is, I suppose, is the other side of...
You get them back in for reviews and you tap them again and you find out what's worked. And a lot of people, I think, will put the blame on themselves if they haven't made any of the changes that we've recommended. But I think it's really important to think about, okay, if there's a change that I've recommended they haven't met, why is that? What are the barriers? And then we kind of delve into things in a little bit more detail, because it's very well setting yourself all these goals, but actually making it really achievable is really important.
Yeah.
That's an opportunity for learning.
Laura, do you feel the weight of responsibility? Because you're often solving problems with nutrition, if you're dealing with individuals, I guess. Whereas if you're dealing with in a company, you're looking at nutritional aspects within a product and you don't quite know what the impact of that is going to have. So I get, does that sort of change the way you go home at night thinking about what you've achieved?
It doesn't. The responsibility is there whether you're looking after an individual or a larger cohort of people. And what's interesting is finding out what would make sense and would resonate with people and how to speak to them. For example, in, you know, COVID, how do you actually help and dispel the myths, and what does that mean for customers, as obviously patterns of the way people eat has changed, and out of home and delivery, and also how people consume information. So social media, you know, people only have a few moments to look at and understand some nutrition element. And we don't really want to be telling people what they want to do. We want to be inspiring and excite people around nutrition.
Yeah. Threatening doesn't really work, does it? Right. Okay, you mentioned COVID, and this is a huge shift, I guess, in how work unfolds. How much do you think the role of a nutritionist has changed over the last 10 or 20 years?
Over the last 10 years, there has been a huge amount of reformulation in manufacturing and in retail. So what's been exciting, and technology has helped to determine how we can change and improve products. So I think we've all experienced sometimes when you go to other countries, you eat something that you might eat in the UK and you notice that it's higher in sugar or it tastes saltier. And that's because we've really made such a difference. And it was around 2013, 2014, there was a lot of media coverage around sugar and products being very high in sugar. So we've really responded to that. So reformulation is almost a baseline element that happens in retailers and manufacturers now. That's been a massive shift.
So when you're reformulating a product, I see it as a sort of a boxing ring. And on one side, you've got the technologies say, well, the sugar makes it work in a certain way. It's a function. And then you on the other side saying, nah, you can't do that, mate. We've got to get this under a certain level of impact. Is it like that, pugilistic?
You're absolutely right, especially at Marks and Spencer, where we want quality and taste to deliver. So that's our absolute, if something doesn't taste as good, then we won't kind of take sugar and salt out. But there are some really nice ways that we are able to do that.
Yeah. Now, Rosie, this is an area of huge innovation recently. We've certainly talked to a lot on the podcast about things like personalised nutrition. What have been the advances that have really changed the work that you do?
I think there's a couple of aspects here. So one aspect would be kind of the science of nutrition. So nutrition is actually a very young science. So we actually only discovered and chemically defined the first nutrient in 1926, so less than 100 years ago. So actually we're seeing a rapid evolution of understanding of nutrition. I think once upon a time we took a very reductionist approach to nutrition. So it would be, you know, this is a nutrient deficiency and this is how we solve it. And I think with the changing landscape of health conditions, we then tried to apply that to the health conditions we have now. Is it fat? Is it salt? That, you know, is it sugar that we're all struggling with? And I think now we're starting to realise that, you know, the holistic side of it is really, really important. You know, there's so many advances in things like learning about the gut microbiome and, as you mentioned, about personalised nutrition, nutrigenomics and epigenetics and all those sorts of things. So that's one area of technology that is completely changing how we're viewing nutrition. But then obviously we've got the whole technology with kind of Zoom and data collection and all of these things that are actually helping us to support individuals. So we're getting more accurate information about what people are eating through apps and various things like that. But also in research. So when we're researching science, we're able to get bigger pieces of data to start understanding it. So I think from that point of view, nutritionists' role has changed because we're just learning all the time.
Yeah.
We're always having to adapt.
And nutritional studies are notoriously difficult to carry out, aren't they? You know, they need to be long term. You're looking at impacts that are really variable in wildly different, you know, human makeups. How much can we trust the research that's out there? How much do you have to go on instinct?
It's a really interesting question because you're right. Nutrition is inherently really difficult to study. It's not like you give someone a drug and you give someone a placebo and there's one pathway for that drug and you study that. Nutrition affects all different things that happen in our body, metabolism, as I mentioned, the gut microbiome. You know, there's different pathways that we metabolize things. And so there's lots of different factors that impact on that. And at the same time, it's really difficult to isolate that because you can't give someone broccoli and someone placebo broccoli. You know what you're eating in many ways. And if you're giving someone one food, it has to then displace another food. So what's the effect of the displacement? There's loads of different factors that come into nutrition. So I think when it comes to trust, it's about building that knowledge. So when we look at a vast array of studies and we start looking at what they're telling us, we can start to build an understanding because science is the pursuit of truth. We never know anything absolute. It's giving us a direction of where we're going with the science. There's never going to, I think the media quite like to take a study or a part of a study and say, this goes against everything we know about nutrition. Whereas actually we need to take that, look at the limitations of that study, put it into context of what we know about nutrition as a whole, because one study doesn't make everything else that we've studied and understand obsolete. It's about that building of knowledge.
Yeah. So Lizzie, is this idea of you know, new research coming out a problem? I mean, because you must need to keep track of this stuff all the time of, okay, suddenly something else, you know, trans fats and saturated fats and things like this. So, you know, there is controversy over them. How much does that actually affect your day-to-day work?
I wouldn't say it's a problem. I'd say it keeps it really exciting for all of us. And I think we picked up on it just before actually came in here. For me, part of my role, I have to make sure I'm keeping up with that research, keeping up with what's going on out there. And a lot of my role is training the chefs and my teams, you know, on what I learn so they can relay it back to our customers and their teams as well. In one way, it's going to keep it a bit hard. You know, there's never one answer. And like Rosie just said, the media sometimes takes a very large study and just picks what they want to know about it. For us, we need to look deeper into it. And then for me, I educate my teams on what I think they need to be taking back to the floor.
And you're working in collaboration with chefs all the time. Yeah. You're training them up. And I mean, does the disinformation that's out there, the frankly fruitcake nonsense that's written about nutrition, get in the way? Do you get people saying, but yeah, but I've read this in the Daily Express and therefore, so this throws, you know, should I believe what you're saying? Is there any pushback from people who are confused by this huge cloud of information?
So I would definitely say occasionally, you know, some of my teams will come to me and say, oh, I've heard this, Lizzie, what do you think of it? And it creates a lovely discussion. I sit with a board of nutritionists for UK hospitality. So we often have a chance to sort of talk about this, debate it occasionally, chat with the other nutritionists in my area. But then a lot of the chefs come to me and think, I've heard this, it must be true, we're going to run with it. But then it's a really nice, you know, chance for me to create a video on it or sit down and educate them all on what I think we should be using in our, you know, in our expertise.
The other element along with the research is also if you survey people or ask them a question, you know, do you want X, Y, and Z sort of nutrition? People say, oh, we really want a healthy cake. Then actually they walk in and to a store and what they do. And, you know, anyone you ask, and that's what's quite exciting about nutrition as well, is actually, as well as the studies, actually asking people what they want.
Yeah, which comes back to your idea that it's actually inspiring them and drawing them towards something rather than pushing them towards
something. And actually on the calorie legislation that was out recently, well, it's been out for a while now, you know, we've had to do calories across all of our sites, so 600 on them. And we got a lot of our customers questioning, oh, I'm not sure that's right, I'm not sure that's right. Oh. And then again, that was an education piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So Rosie, do you have problems with misinformation and correcting it with your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is an area that, well, you know, as we've mentioned, social media is something that has blown up and it's a double-edged sword. We all know that, you know, it comes with the good because it means that people who, you know, have a really interesting and trustworthy stories to tell about nutrition and sharing things, people who are wanting that information, if they find those trustworthy sources, you know, it's a really good way to share and it makes it accessible. But at the same time, I think you do get a lot of very polarizing views on nutrition. So when we come to topics like intermittent fasting, organic food, ketogenic diets, all of these things are very polarized. And so I think if someone comes to it with a certain viewpoint, they follow the people that agree with them, you can get into these echo chambers of information. So people can go down a road and really believe that they're true and not actually see any of the other information out there. So that can be absolutely tricky. And I think it's just about trying to communicate the science with people and actually sit down and say, you know, this is what is really going on. And it's not just what you heard on social media, even if it's been re-emphasized so many times. But yeah, it is a big part of the job. So it's important to keep on top of what is being talked about out there and make sure that you have your, you know, your educated viewpoint and help to try and communicate that. And also, I think it's important for nutritionists and dietitians to be more active on social media as well. It's not for everyone. Not everyone's going to want to do that. Some people just want to, you know, do their job in the hospital or whatever it is. But I think actually those people who want to put themselves out there, it's really important because there's so much being said. The more we can have people who have a very trustworthy and educated viewpoint is going to help with that.
There's also a lot of people out there that like to call themselves nutritionists or more the nutritionist word, and actually they haven't got anything behind them. So the accreditation for us is really important and, you know, making sure we're using that well.
I've sat on panels on TV with people who turned up 6 months later and they were then, you know, they were journalists and then they were nutritionists. And so, okay, do any of you have a favourite bit of nutritional misinformation?
I think the main one for me at the moment is the carnivore diet. That is one that's really exploding and people are following and just eating animal products, leaving out all plant foods. And you'd be surprised how many people are doing it. Yeah, I cannot wrap my head around that because none of the science.
It just makes a good photo, doesn't it, of somebody with a steak hanging out of their mouth. Anyone else?
For me, it would be I'm going gluten-free because it's healthier. And you hear that a lot. Yeah. And it's a bit of a battle.
So Laura, how big a part of your role then is about consumer education? I mean, yeah, you can only take on so much, really, can't you? That you're trying to build products that work, build products that are healthy within a framework. Do you also have to educate people?
What we try and do is, like I said, is inspire people, and sustainability. That's one of the biggest elements that have come through and changed for nutritionists over the last few years. So there's an element of how do we fit nutrition and sustainability together? Because I think that can be confusing, and some people might think if I'm trying to be healthy, how am I sustainable as well? So in terms of that, how we put that together to help people to eat in a more sustainable and nutritious way. And what we've done at M&S, and I can't take credit for inventing it because it's been around since 2005, is we have the Eat Well Sunflower. So in all our products that have a positive nutritional benefit and a health claim, they have a sunflower on it. So again, that's playing into that. None of us spend very long dwelling at the shelves. But if you saw that little sunflower, you could know that will help make your basket more nutrition.
Yeah. I guess a part of the problem, Lizzie, is that there, nutritional, there is no one diet for one person, is there? You're dealing with so many different aspects, and yet you're serving food to thousands of people every day. So how do you balance it? Is there a moral imperative, or are you just doing what you can?
So I would say from my point of view, it's about educating, inspiring again, helping them make those right choices, but you can't take the other choices away. So what we do is we always promote what we see as the healthiest, the most nutritious, the most balanced meal, you know, on our shelves.
The pork belly's still there on the menu.
It'll still be there hiding. At the moment, the WELL standards are a big thing that a lot of our sites are going for. And with that, it's all about promotion where, you know, you've still got to maybe have those chips there, but they should be for people to really go and look for and have to ask for them.
Yeah.
So that's the promotion and the educating.
And this whole thing about standards and accreditation and where, I mean, again, nutrition is so complex. Is there a debate in your work about how much information you put on the food or on the menu or on the label?
Yeah, so actually at Baxter Story this year, we're going for the big approach. It's just a holistic approach to nutrition. We're not going to go marketing it and putting it, you know, it doesn't need to be shouted about. It should just be there, and we should be influencing people's choice about how good the food looks, what's on the menu, and they should just want to go for that one, not sort of shouting about, oh, this is the healthy option, you know, here you go. It should just be there and it's the one that people want to go for.
Yeah. And Laura, is there a sort of fight for packaging space to put your message across? I mean, you talked about the sunflower. That's one that's sort of, you know, using semiotics, I guess. But is that a sort of a battle to try and get more information on this?
I guess you don't want to, it all becomes wallpaper if there's too much messaging. So you're absolutely right. We want clean. We really celebrate the food at M&S, and you'll see that a lot of our packaging is clear so you can see what. So yes, so that's why the Eat Well Little Sunflower is a shortcut, just so that it's clean on the packaging and you can make make the right food choices, along with the front of pack labelling as well. And we've used things like we've got a partnership with FIFA, and we've used TV advertising to help promote products.
Football, rugby, there's a pattern emerging. Okay, so let's shift the conversation a little bit. Rosie, how do you keep up with the latest developments in nutritional science? And how much of your time is actually spent? You know, do you have to start the day going through all those emails going, oh, I thought that was true, and now this is true, and you have to do the research? And if so, how do you go about it?
So as a dietitian, we are given certain amounts of time to be able to do that. So we call it CPD, continued professional development, and it's a required part of our to be licensed as a dietitian. So I think one of the really lovely things about going into this area is if you enjoy being a student, you're pretty much a student lifelong because you're always learning. There's always a part of your job that is going to be reading new evidence, understanding things, you know, looking up, listening to webinars and podcasts and those sorts of things, which I really, really enjoy. So it's actually a great part of what I do. So you are given that time. But I think if it's your passion, then it's something you'll probably take into your own time as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. Whatever sort of area you're in is going to direct where you're going to go for those types of things. But I think that's one reassuring thing is you never have to know everything because it's such a vast topic. There's real opportunities for learning all the time. So it might be from a patient or a client asking me about certain thing. I can say, well, I'm not too sure about that. I can go away and that will prompt me to do some research. Or it might be something in media headlines that you think something odd's going on here. I'm going to read into that and you go back to the studies. So yeah, it's a real mix of things that you can do just to keep up to date.
Okay, so we've got a group of people who are probably interested in nutrition here. For all three of you, do you have any websites, Facebook groups, particularly newsletters, preferably free, I would add, that you can recommend in order to keep up with nutritional news? What do you use?
NutriWeb is a big one for CPDs. They've got regular CPDs that if you can't make the time, you can then listen to a recording and journals and stuff that's really good for keeping up with new research. And they all count towards your CPD hours that you need to do as a registered dietitian or nutritionist.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
I would agree. Yeah, I often use my NutriWeb. And yeah, I think on your area as well, you'll get journals that come up over and over again that you might turn back to. I'm a member of an organisation called Plant-Based Health Professionals UK. So there's lots of information that comes out from them. They do kind of reviews of some of the studies for me, which is always useful. So yeah, it depends on your area, but those are the kind of two big ones that I would use.
Yeah. Laura, anything would you add to that, or are they the standards?
Yes, I absolutely love the book club that my NutriWeb run as well, because then you're enjoying the book and then can discuss it with fellow nutritionists. So that's great. We are also members of the British Nutrition Foundation, who again can review them, and they've done the in-depth review, but do a bit of a shortcut for you, so you know that it's based in science.
Yeah, that's really useful, isn't it?
I think it's also important. So obviously absorbing information and getting information from these places is important, but also they encourage reflective practice as well. So actually when you've been working in an area or you've seen a certain person or actually taking time to reflect on how it went, what you did, what you could have done better, those sorts of things. So that reflection is on what you're doing.
That's really useful, especially if you're working on your own. Yeah. You don't want to feel like you're in a bubble. You want to feel part of the whole team. So Laura, slightly different discussion now. How central are nutritionists when it comes to new product development? We had a panel on new product development yesterday, and they talked a lot about collaboration. They're not just sitting in a room doing their own thing. Do you get drawn into lots of different discussions about, we've got an exciting new thing, but we need to make sure of X? Are you part of lots of different discussions?
Yes. In terms of NPD, so we have product developers, food technologists, buyers, and we have a trends team. So as you're saying, everyone works together. And the food technologists are the ones that really implement a lot from a technology point of view. And then if they need additional help, then we'll come in.
And do you ever sort of come up, is your role also creative? Do you ever sort of come in the morning and go, I've just had a thought. You know what? If we did X, that would make an extraordinary product. Is it open in that way?
Yes, absolutely. And that's what makes it really exciting. So something very simple that I did that was really effective when, you know, there was a lot of school closures during COVID and there was a lot of concern about children that normally get free school meals, how are they being fed and how are people coping with that additional burden of cost of having all the children at home? And we created a meal planner, which was then signposted in store, and that was really effective. And because of social media, we could we could put that really quickly and directly help our customers. That was really exciting.
Okay, and now another slightly different topic. We've got an all-female, fantastic all-woman panel here, and with one stale middle-aged white man at the end of it. There have been various reports about a lack of men in working in nutrition. Certainly, I've had very few male nutritionists on the podcast and loads of brilliant women. Does this chime with your experience, Lizzie? Is it an all-woman industry?
Yeah, so in my two previous nutrition roles, all female brigades, hadn't worked with a male before. In my current role, I am obviously in hospitality, so I'm the nutritionist working with the food team and lots of other employees, and it's a mostly male brigade, but we're doing so much at the moment for my industry to really up the women. We've got women in hospitality industry. We work with a chef called Ruth Hansom, who really sort of is trying to encourage women chefs into our industry, and hopefully in turn that will mean I'm working with more females. So for me, it's probably a bit of a different spin. But my other nutrition roles, yeah, totally female. And when I studied my degree, there was one male on our course.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? Laura, does this matter?
I don't think it does matter too much. In terms of sports, when I was in sports nutrition, it was actually the other way around. So you see a lot more men. So I don't think it matters in terms of if someone's passionate about nutrition and they want to do the role and they're the best person for the job. But equally, it's great to get different points of view, and everyone, if you have a different background and if you're a different gender, it brings different insights.
Yeah, absolutely. Does that kind of ring a chord for you? I mean, there are, I guess, different nutritional issues, but you can have your head around all of them, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I have exactly the same experience. In my degree, it was very, very outnumbered in terms of men to women. I think it is changing. I think there are more men coming through, but I think it stems from the historical roles of men and women and the fact that the kind of historical start of nutrition and dietetics came from kind of a home economics type of area, which is why I think it's heavily female. But I do think it's changing. I do think it matters, because I think having more inclusivity in any profession is important, because I think it helps to bring more different people into that role, and also the people we serve are diverse. So I think the more we can have different voices within that is really important.
I'd actually say for me at the moment, so I'm building like a committee within my company, and a lot of people that are speaking up and saying I've got a real passion for nutrition or want to get involved are males. So it's definitely changing.
Yeah. Okay. And we better just finish with one question to all of you about the future. Really, is there one advance you would like to see? Is there a problem that needs solving? Is there a future version of your job that you would like to see?
We've mentioned a little bit about accreditation and CPD. As the Association for Nutritionists Registrar, I volunteered to do that role. We are pushing for a chartership, so that just like you have a chartered accountant, nutrition titles should become chartered as well. So we are waiting for that at the moment. So that would be fantastic, because it will be easier to determine who is registered, just as dietitians are registered, be able to know who can actually dispel those myths and understand the science.
So you can't turn up on a panel saying one week saying you're a journalist and the next as a nutrition. Absolutely. Lizzie, what would you like to see happening over the next 5-10 years?
At the moment, I'm very interested in the personalised nutrition. And obviously, like you said, for our sites, we work with thousands of people, so we'd have to look at it a very different way. But there's definitely, what could we do on our menus that could sort of affect people? You know, they could make choices that would then affect them differently throughout the day. And the personalised thing is going to really grow, I think, in the next few years.
Any clues as to how that might happen? Would it be a little QR code next to the item on a menu that you could add that to your...
It could maybe just as simple as everyone having an app. It doesn't even have to be down the DNA route, just sort of a few key things, how active you are, what you do during the day when you get your slumps. And then you could have foods there that would, you know, high in fiber, this is going to help you, or, you know, big salad bars, things like that. So not even as complicated as the QR code, just little added extras on the menu.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay, Rosie, what do you think about the future? What would you hope for?
Yeah, I'm a really big advocate of putting diet into context. So not just what I've talked about in terms of putting into the context of people's lifestyles, but into global issues. So I think it's really, really important for nutritionists and dietitians of the future to be considering things like sustainability, climate impact, risk of pandemics, antibiotic resistance. There's just so much that nutrition as a science is fascinating. And, you know, thinking about how nutrition affects the human body is what we need to learn more about that. Absolutely. But there won't be a nutritionist of the future if we're not including these things into our conversations and into our advice that we're giving. So there's all sorts of really interesting, and this is why it's really nice to be here as a nutritionist working with people in food industry as well, because they have to go hand in hand. So when we're thinking about innovations in food products, then, you know, that's going to be a really important part of the future, because we're thinking about, you know, the inefficiency of our food system, animal agriculture, all those things. And I think that there will be things that will start to replace those things. Things like, I don't know if you've heard of precision fermentation, you know, there's all sorts of sci-fi sounding things out there that is fascinating, which is something that George Monbiot was talking about. But I think the nutritionists and dietitians need to be part of that conversation. We are the nutrition communicators, and we need to be including those conversations in what we're talking about, and supporting food manufacturers to support human health at the same time as creating these new products.
Absolutely fantastic answers. Okay, there's so much to talk about, but let's throw this open to the audience for questions. If you've got a question, we would love to hear it. So I think there's somebody here in the middle.
Hi, wonderful talk, by the way. I really enjoyed it. My name's Ludmilla. I study nutrition and medical sciences at UCL. My question was on the topic of like controversial things in nutrition is, what are your opinions on vegetable oils or seed oils, and whether or not you think they're pro-inflammatory? Because I've been seeing a lot of debate on social media between nutritionists on this topic. So I'd like to know how you feel about it.
I think it's another one that's blown up a little bit unnecessarily. It's one of those things that people will have such strong opinions on. But actually, when we go into the science and we look into it, actually, if you're moving away from more saturated fats, going for more unsaturated fats, that's going to make the biggest difference. And I think that it's a bit, don't want to use the word scaremongering, but a lot of people do talk about it as being, you know, seed oils being the absolute worst thing that you could have. And it's not true.
Okay. Any other questions?
Hi, I'm Elliot. I study history and political economy at King's College London, and I'm doing a master's in food security next year. I'm quite interested in how do apps like MyFitnessPal, which give people access to, you know, basic nutritional information, nutritional tracking, impact your work on client advisory and also on new product development?
That pretty much goes to you as well then, Rosie, doesn't it? When we're talking about, because you're talking about individuals really coming to you with and saying, well, I've got this information here.
So tracking definitely has become something that's been way more accessible for everyone these days. And in some ways it can be useful when we're kind of taking a snapshot of what someone's been eating. We can do a little bit of a breakdown. I think we do need to remember that they're not entirely accurate, and the information that we get from them depends on how accurate the information we put into them was and you know, according to the database. So we have to take them with a little pinch of salt. But I do sometimes get people to do that for a short period of time just so that I can get that information on what kind of nutrition they're getting in their diet. But I think there, again, is a bit of a double-edged sword, because a lot of people will count on those things and get a little bit obsessed with them and, you know, try and meet certain things. And I think it becomes that kind of culture of calorie counting, how much percentage of protein am I getting, how much of this am I getting? And it gets very kind of detailed. And we don't necessarily need that when we're thinking about supporting our nutrition. And I think for some people that can be detrimental in many ways. So again, it can be useful, but I think that for some people, it can be detrimental.
And Laura, in the second part of the question, how much does it fit into NPD, that a consideration of what information people are getting from apps?
At the moment, it doesn't influence NPD in terms of how we'll develop a product, but we have got a close watch on personalized nutrition and what's most useful for our customers. So we're keeping a watch on that. But for me, personalized nutrition, been around for 10 years and there's been some development, but it's been a little bit slower than I anticipated, actually. And when you're scaling everything up, how do you keep things as personalized nutrition but on a large scale? That's actually really, really challenging to deliver. I think precision nutrition will really come to its own in 10 to 20 years. And some people, for certain events, just like you train for a marathon and consider your exercise training and your nutrition, I think even for business meetings or whatever you want to deliver, I think that's going to come through. And then obviously then we need to really understand how we can support people to do that and which foods and which products we'll package up and help to support people in that way.
Did you just mention the idea of nutrition preparation for a business meeting?
Yes.
That's brilliant. I love that. The idea that you could eat well for something really specific. Mm. Brilliant. Okay. Any more questions? Over here on the far left.
Hi, I'm Caroline. I'm a performance nutritionist and also science communications manager at the Nutrition Society. My question's really for Laura and Lizzie. We've got loads of members throughout, like, you know, sort of pre-nutrition studies to graduates to PhD students to like mid-career wanting to maybe make a switch to different field of nutrition. And I guess knowing you guys have a background in sort of working one-on-one with clients or sports teams, how did you transition to industry?
For me, so I went from doing a lot of individual nutrition, which was great for a while. And then it was, you know, a lot of one-on-one and it just wasn't suiting me. You know, I'm a big foodie at heart and nutrition food was where I always wanted to end up being. And that's how I got to where I am now. And I would say for anyone looking to go into nutrition, it's a great place to be because you can take your scientific knowledge, you then use it to train others and inspire others. And then you're also a big process of developing that delicious food that's going out to thousands of customers.
For me, it was when I was finishing my master's and I was working with some sports teams, but because I was writing my dissertation, I took a bit of time out of my freelance work. And then, so it tailed off slightly. And I saw a job advertised for a retailer. They wanted 6 years experience in industry and I didn't have any. So I sent an email saying, I don't have the experience, but if there's some elements of the job I can support you on whilst you're finding somebody, then I'd really like to do that if that could help. And they struggled to get the right person to do the job. So I was fortunate and started doing that role. And then that became a full-time employment. So take those chances if you see an opportunity and something interests you, if you're passionate and willing and hardworking and really listen to what someone else needs and how you can support them, then just go for it.
Such a renegade, wasn't it? And our last question, we've just got time for, over here on the far left.
I'm Jess and I study human nutrition at Basbar University. My question's more around like portion sizes. So like as a nutritionist in a company, an like industry company, that is a lot of importance and focus around portion sizes of the products and like how like you're going to market it and kind of make that more aware and like suggested serving sizes. And then kind of following that, do you think, for example, because you've reformulated products that might be like, oh, we've got 30% less fat or 30% less sugar, could this encourage people to think, oh, I can eat more of this product now, and they may kind of not really understand about what the portion size could be and they could overeat that?
It's a great question. So this is real nuts and bolts stuff here, isn't it? Lizzie, I think this is one for you. Portion size and reformulation. I mean, you know, let's talk about the absolute basics, really.
Yeah, so for me, I work a lot, you know, varied clients and sites, whatever. We often would have a recommended portion size that we'd serve. You then often get people asking for more, which is fine. We then often have some weigh and pay, which you'd often suggest a portion size and that's up to them. A lot of it's down to customer choice, but I do a lot on educating our teams that can then help our customers on what they should be having. When the calorie legislation came out, a lot of people were quite shocked with what the portion had. And, you know, that's when a few of the questions came. We were prepared, ready to answer that. With the low fat, low sugar thing at the moment, a lot of what I'm trying to do is we try and, you know, low fat, a lot of people think is healthier when actually it's got a much higher sugar content. So it's that education piece again about, you know, we're not taking that fat out because it will in turn increase the sugar. So for me, it's the education of my teams that then help our customers.
Fantastic. Okay, well, that's about what we've got time for. Absolutely fascinating discussion. So let's just say thank you to Lizzie Henning, Rosie Martin and Laura Street. Thank you so much for joining. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? They make a huge difference and we read them all. Thank you so much to our guests, to our audience, and to you at home for listening.